For our weary pilgrims, the road ended at Zion. The hundreds or thousands of miles they travelled to meet with God's people finished in the courts of the temple at Jerusalem, where sacrifices could be made, the promise of atonement given, their great God worshipped together. From the Temple Mount, they could gain a spiritual perspective that would sustain them through the long walk home and the many months they would spend living among godless pagan people, those who would mock and oppress them. Today, as I've already hinted, we reach the summit of the Psalms of Ascent. This, Psalm 132, is their high point. This is the place where you will see the furthest. This is a place where you can see from horizon to horizon, where it will seem like all the whole world and its many nations are laid out before you. We still, if you've flicked ahead and read, you'll notice we have two more Psalms of Ascent, two more songs. But in a sense, as we'll look at in the next 2 weeks, they're both goodbye psalms. Songs to sing as we leave or get ready to leave the temple. Psalm 132 is the first psalm in the final cycle of three, the apex. We're at the peak, the trig point. It's downhill all the way. Today, if you'll allow a little drama, I invite you to join me on Zion's peak as we see the view that God has laid out. Like the pilgrims of Psalm 121, looking to the mountains. Like the watchmen of Psalm 130, waiting for the dawn. We'll stand and see just what it was that God had promised that could sustain a scattered people living thousands of years in exile, oppression, and shared trauma. And much like football, this is a game of two halves. We've got two halves, 2 points. We see David's promise to God, or his vow to God. Once again, at the start of this psalm, the writer reminds God of something he surely must remember. David and all his self-denial. He starts by reminding the Lord of David's zeal. Now the reason for this is made clear in 10. For the sake of your servant David, whose zeal we want you to remember, do not reject your anointed one. Now this, on the first half of the psalm, help us to understand that these verses are a prayer of protection for the king, the centre of Israel's hopes as a nation, the king and the priesthood, the ruler and the worship of God together. Their hope is centred in the king, but it will already have struck you that though I've mentioned this was probably written by Solomon or during his reign, if Solomon himself didn't write it, I've pointed out several times through this series that the Psalms of the Psalms of Ascent, these 15 songs, were gathered together and put in this hymn book, if you like, after the return from the Babylonian exile. This is a time when Israel doesn't have a king. If it was sung when Zerubbabel was governor, you know, in the time of Nehemiah and Ezra, at least one of David's heirs was. He was never a king. David's throne is empty. Perhaps that was the situation that made this prayer all the more poignant, all the more desperate. The people are worried, genuinely worried, that the Davidic line has been rejected for all its many failings, its sins. So like Israel in captivity in Egypt, they call on the Lord for mercy. And they remind him of just what it was that made David so worthy. As we remembered last week, through the course of his life, David had done many things that made him unworthy. He'd had to learn to be humble the hard way. But the focus here is not on all that, it's on David's zeal, centered in a promise he made to God, a vow, an oath. Well, we had that reading earlier from 1 Chronicles that reminded us of the setting. After he'd conquered Jerusalem and placed the king, placed his palace, his rule there, David was uneasy, to put it mildly, by the loss of the ark and by the fact that there was no permanent place for the worship of God in Israel. The Ark of the Covenant, remember, was a symbolic footstool. It says that, the footstool in verse 7. It was a sign of God's sovereign authority, the place from where he would rule, you know, like a king putting his feet on this footstool and saying, everything under this is my kingdom, is my authority. And it was a sign of his presence among the people of God. If God's footstool was there, then surely God would be present with the people. He'd chosen to place himself among the midst of the people, presence himself with them. Now, of course, he couldn't be restrained to a tent or a temple, however magnificently appointed it might have been. And remember that the temple that was rebuilt after it had been destroyed by the Babylonians was not as impressive as the one that had been before. Not until the time of Herod would a more architecturally impressive building be built on the same site. But a permanent house of the Lord will be a sign to the people that God was permanently their God. It was a solid sign to the people that he had adopted them and chosen them to be his. And so we read, after he returned the ark, of David's commitment to build a house for the Lord. How could he sleep easy in his bed, in a great palace, this beautiful cedar building, while the ark of God was in a tent, something that could be pitched and struck at a moment's notice? And so, however foolhardy it was to make such a vow without first consulting the Lord, you know, Nathan says to him, yeah, whatever you've got in mind to do, that's great. And then God speaks to Nathan and says, actually, Nathan, I've got a slightly different plan here. But David swore an oath to the Lord to build him a dwelling. His heart was in the right place. No wonder the Bible can say that this was a man after God's own heart. And verses 6 to 8 remind us of how they brought the ark back to Jerusalem. From his earliest home in Bethlehem, Ephrathah. That's what Ephrathah means here. It's Bethlehem, because remember, there's two Bethlehems. And this is reminding us this is David's Bethlehem. And from there, David heard of where the ark was. And he's speaking kind of poetically here. In the fields of Ja'ar, which is another name for Kiriath Jearim, where the ark was. You can read about that in 1 Chronicles 13. After the death of Uzzah, maybe you remember, he put his hand out to steady the ark as it was rocked, and he was struck by the Lord. And David panicked and left the ark there, and then it started blessing the people whose land it had been left on, and that encouraged David to go and bring the ark according to his zeal and passion, but as God had said, got the Levites to carry it properly, and he brought the ark to Jerusalem. And as they set out, they would have accompanied it with the traditional phrase, "Arise, Lord." That's what Moses had said every time the ark was about to set out. "Arise, Lord." You can check that in Numbers 10, verse 35. Unlike other religions of the time, you'll come across people who tell you that the Israelites, and it's only sort of in hindsight, as people have put the Bible together, that they've made the Israelites different. And that's just not true. There's no evidence for that. All the evidence points to how different Israel was from every other people. All were different. They weren't under the impression they could imprison or properly symbolise their God with a statue or a graven image. Remember, the ark, the footstool, is a box. It's not a symbol of God, it's a box. It's a gilded arrow pointing to heaven, saying all this underneath is God's. It belongs to him. He rules over it. This means that you couldn't just own God by owning the ark. Like the Philistines learned when they captured it, if you've seen it, like the Nazis there learn and their faces melt, owning a box does not give you power over God. Because you own or you have in your possession the king's footstool, it does not give you control over the king. It might be a sign that the king will come and put his feet up where the box is, but you can't control him because of it. If you want him to act, if you want him to move, if you want him to be with you, you can't just parade a statue around like all the other religions would do and sort of say, this is our God, he's with us. You need to call on him. You need to ask, to pray that he's gracious to arise and go before you. And then you just follow. You follow the cloud. You follow the glory. You don't dictate where it goes. You go where he leads. These were David's motivations in wanting to bring the ark to Jerusalem. It was his love for the Lord and his love for his people that made him want to permanently marry the two by building a temple at Jerusalem. As we read, as we'll see in a moment, however grand the promise, David wasn't the one who will be allowed to build a temple. He'd been too bloodthirsty. He'd been made unclean by all the death that he'd been involved in. It was, you know, Solomon who ended up building the temple. But nevertheless, he, David, was permitted to make all kinds of preparations for it, getting all the materials ready. Lord, remember David and all his self-denial. This is a very good translation. Some of the Bibles put it a bit differently. It's almost a paraphrase of the verse to help us understand what it means. Remember David's self-denial. Remember, Lord, all that David gave up to build the temple, or to make sure that the temple would be built. All the money he paid, all the resources, the timber and the gold that he had to buy in, all the treasure that was his as the king of Israel. It was his. He could have just kept it and hoarded it, but he made it available to fund this amazing building project. David knew there were no pockets in shrouds. And he knew that without the Lord, the people, his people, would have no hope. He set aside a fortune so that the temple could be built. There was no price too high to pay to guarantee God's blessing. What a promise to make. What a zeal to have. Perhaps you look and you think about David's self-denial, and you feel ashamed, or you feel your conscience start to be pricked for how little you contribute. In either time, energy, or money, how little love you have to give to the work of the Lord now. Perhaps you are faithful to give at least a tenth of your income to the local church and gospel work, but you'd hardly describe your attitude as generous or zealous. You know, maybe you see that 10% is just like, well, if I pay that, no one in the church leadership would rather have that money. Do we begrudge the time we're expected to spend in prayer? Or the time we're expected to spend reading our Bibles, the time we're expected to spend giving serious thought, meditating on the things of God, so that we are better equipped for the acts of service that all Christians are called to? And what if we compare David's zeal to the greater zeal of his greater son? We read in the Gospels how Jesus was often in prayer. You know, if you ever read some of the old biographies of Puritans and the like, and they get up at 3 a.m. and pray for 5 hours, and then when they die, they've worn a hole in the carpet next to their bed from kneeling, or oak timber has been sort of got two knee grooves in because they spent so long in prayer. How much more Jesus prayed? He would get up early. He would fast. He He would spend whole nights in prayer sometimes. Go to a quiet place at the top of a mountain and talk with his Father. And all that he did as a man with ordinary human capacities. He demonstrated the simple possibility of genuine zeal for God, as well as exemplifying a truly spiritual life to us. Now, if you are not aware how far short of that mark you fall, you're dangerously deluding yourself. If you think that anything you've ever done is enough to satisfy the perfect standard of the Holy God, then your opinion of your Creator is too low. The pilgrims who sang this song would pray, "Lord, remember David and all his self-denial. For his sake, have mercy on us, undeserving though we are. How much more should we pray, Lord, remember Jesus, the greater David, and all his self-denial. For his sake, have mercy, undeserving though we really are." But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. David made to God, but God responded not with thank you very much, but with a promise of his own. We're looking now at the second half of the psalm and God's promise to David. "The Lord swore to David a sure oath he will not revoke, one of your own descendants I will place on your throne." Verses 1 to 10 are a prayer. And the rest of this psalm is God's response to that prayer. David promised to build God a house. And God answered, promising to build David a house. There's a conditionality to that promise. If you look at verse 12. "If," it's an important word, "if David's sons kept the covenant and lived according to God's law, they will be kept on the throne forever." But they didn't. Some of them were half-hearted in their zeal. Some were outright rebellious. And after the exile, there was no longer a Davidic king in Jerusalem. Never again. But in his mercy, God preserved the line of promise. According to the stipulations of the covenant, he was under no obligation. He could have just wiped out the line of David. But he didn't. He showed mercy. God's people, even his anointed kings, were faithless. But God proved himself to be faithful. The line was kept alive. The records of the genealogies were kept intact until finally, hundreds of years later, in the reign of Augustus Caesar, Quirinius being governor of Syria, in fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, a son of David was born in Bethlehem. Despite how unworthy they were, the line of David, God in his grace had determined to fulfill his promises. This way, there was no one who could point to their own obedience and show how they had forced God to act. How they bound him up in legal red tape so we have no choice but to bless. God showed compassion in spite of their disobedience so that he alone would deserve the praise and the joyful thanks of his covenant people. In fact, if you look at the first half of the psalm again and compare it with the second, you'll notice something, I think. We need to perhaps be careful. But there's an unavoidable implication as you compare the two. The prayer, verse 10, pleads mercy for David's sake on account of his zeal. It sort of says, because of this thing that he has done, show mercy. They plead the merit of their representative, the king, the anointed one, and ask that that be the reason they be treated favourably. And then verses 11 to 12, reminded of the Davidic covenant, a covenant which was broken within the reign of David himself. And though sometimes revived with half-hearted or whole-hearted zeal, It was never fulfilled as it should be, with the wholeness of heart that it demanded. The response focuses not truly on how well this covenant will be kept by any one Davidic king, but by God's a switch between the two hearts. He swore an oath to David that will not be revoked. The Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his blessing. Whatever the obedience on David's part, whatever the zeal of the people, God's will, his desire is first and foremost to that being fulfilled. It's no longer a conditional promise. There's no ifs here. The people are still thinking in those terms, and there's something prophetic there. They don't understand the implications of what they're saying. But God says, I will promise blessing to my people, and it's purely my choice to do that, because I have a purpose for them. They might not deserve it, but I've decided to do it anyway. We're talking about grace here, an undeserved gift of love. I think of Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you, even if that's what you deserve. Plans to give you a hope and a future. Why? Because he has chosen to do so. Because he is God. From the height of Zion, we see in these verses the promise of that plan. The plan to prosper and not to harm. Just how it would be that God would guarantee blessing and a hope and a future for his people. Here in Zion, I will make a horn grow for David and set up a lamp for my anointed one. I will clothe his enemies with shame, but his head will be adorned with a radiant crown. This is the promise. There will be a Davidic king who will reign in power and light. He will be a lamp that shines to the furthest ends of the earth. He will be absolutely victorious over his enemies. The hope of the people of Zion will be guaranteed by the authoritative reign of this king. Just compare, if you like, the prayer of verse 9. And God's promise in response in verses 15 and 16. There's this parallel structure that you can compare the two. The response to so much greater than what was requested. The people have a place and a priesthood so they can worship their God properly. But God promises so much more. Abundant provision, satisfaction, peace, clothed not just with righteousness or victory, but in salvation, eternal health and security. Now here's where we can see the extent of God's promise to David applied to us. These promises, as I'm sure you're aware, are fulfilled in one Davidic king, the one anointed son who kept the covenant and the statutes perfectly, who never said no to God, who reigns eternally because he has conquered death and the grave, and in so doing has conquered death and the grave for all those whose hopes are in him. The one whose self-denial outstripped David's, whose righteousness is such that any who tap into it have an infinite ocean of mercy in which to drown their sins. Jesus is David's heir. He is the now and forever king who rules from heaven, whose Zion is not just a single town in the Middle East, but whose kingdom stretches over the whole earth, whose people are no longer Jews only, but Jews and Gentiles like us here this morning. People of every tribe and tongue and nation and social background and ethnicity and gender, all. Everything that went before was a sequence of signposts that helped God's people understand the immensity of the glory that was to come. It was this hope this promise that there would be a new David. However impossible it seemed, humanly speaking, however impossible it seemed that David's throne would ever have something on it again, when they were conquered by Assyria and Babylon and Rome, forever ruled by foreign oppressors, forever having godless, idolatrous people ruining their temple, abominating their worship, beating them, overtaxing them, overburdening them, cursing, persecuting and oppressing them. And yet the pilgrims kept returning to Jerusalem year after year. They were confident that though their situation seemed hopeless, their God would not let them down. The wait might be long, but God's purposes could not be denied. Jesus Christ is the King, now and forever. He is anointed and crowned Messiah. He's the second Adam, the ultimate David, our man, seated at the right hand of his Father. He reigns everywhere and is present wherever his people are. Do you know for sure that you stand in David's greater son and not with his shamed enemies? Are you trusting in the zeal of Jesus Christ to vindicate you? Or are you building your hope on the sand, on anything else, not knowing that God has pronounced the failure of the means of salvation that won't stand up to the storm? Whenever you start to doubt God's presence in your life, when the news headlines or your own difficult circumstances cause you to lose sight of all the permanent and eternal blessings you have as a priest of God Most High, go to the top of the mountain. Climb to the place you've been granted access by the blood of the Lamb, and stand in the radiant light of his crowned head. Enjoy the view of all Christ's domain and know that he is in charge. He's working all things to the good of his city temple, what he has claimed as his permanent resting place. If you know that you've been chosen to be part of the dwelling place of God Almighty, the stamp promises that God has made, your every need will be provided for. You will be filled and satisfied with food better than any that the world has. Given robes of righteousness and victory to wear by the gracious hands of a sovereign, saving Father. Given the opportunity to join a choir whose joyful will never end. Let's stand and sing 756. God has promised many things, treasures from a heavenly store. Now in Christ, the echo sounds yes to all he said before.